Previously on The Philanthropist Conversation. We went around London with a special tour guide. We wanted to know, how does urban heat work? How does it affect our health, our lifestyle, our public services? We found that not everyone is equal in the face of urban heat. Temperatures change with the architecture and density of the city. Water, greenery, building materials, there are many environmental factors that impact urban heat. And heat, it's a systemic issue. If we want to live with it, we need to get organized, individually and with our peers. Social architecture will help us get there. How does a city respond effectively to urban heat? What do we need to organize political action? And crucially, how can social architecture help us achieve our goals? We find out today.
Imagine this. The year is 2026. It's June 9th, a Tuesday like any other. It's been pretty warm today. You come home from work, take a shower, get into fresh clothes. You make dinner. Then you sit in front of the TV. Next thing you see is a map of Europe, covered in red all the way to the north of France.
The Met Office has issued a provisional warning today, advising against all travel to France for the upcoming month.
A mass of hot air is coming from the Maghreb and traveling to Europe through Spain and Portugal. At first, winds from the Atlantic coast will protect the region, but over the next 2 weeks, heat is going to rise steadily across all of Western Europe. At their peak, temperatures are expected to rise to 50 degrees. We now have 10 days to respond to this emergency scenario. So what happens next?
Well, to answer that question, we need to start getting ready now. What you just heard is a fictional scenario based on realistic climate predictions, and it was created by members of the French authorities to inform the public and prepare institutions for an emergency heat crisis. Intrigued? Well, so am I. That's why I hopped on the Eurostar today. I'm Paula Silverfields. I'm an environmental scientist based in London. I've been living in Europe my whole life, and over the last few summers, I've seen heat waves come and go, breaking new records year after year. So in this series, we're going to talk about urban heat. We're going to study it, learn how to react to it, and start new conversations to look beyond what we already know. Together, let's imagine the future of our cities when heat becomes our day-to-day. Today, we're crossing the channel to visit a place that is all about political engagement. It's a city you'd know for its picturesque architecture and its revolutionary spirit, the one and only Paris. In this episode, we meet up with my friend Guillaume Bernard. We map out the city's design and unpack how Paris handles heat. Then we'll join Eliane Vermeil, a representative of the mayor's office. We'll discuss Paris's long history of political engagement in the field of resilience and find out how the city government operates today. Eliane will introduce us to Clément Damas, one of her collaborators from the private sector. Finally, we'll get the privilege to meet Alexandra Florentine, a leader in the field of heat resilience here. We'll ask what it takes to connect with civil society and engage actors across the board. This is The Philanthropist Conversation. Or should I say, La Conversation Philanthrope. Welcome to Paris. Okay, let me go down the escalators here. Ah yes, this is familiar now. Hey Guillaume, a quick voice note to let you know that I'm just at the Gare du Nord now. I'm going to wait for you inside the station at the small bakery booth, if that's okay. See you there in a minute.
Bonjour madame, comment je peux vous aider? Il vous faut quelque chose en particulier?
Yes, a café allongé, s'il vous plaît.
No problem, long black coming up.
I see you've picked up on the local order.
Oh, hi Guillaume. You were so quick, I thought I'd have a few minutes to grab a coffee, but you swooped in.
Well, I got in early because there's a transport strike going on at the moment, so not all lines work. You know how it is.
I guess that's how you know you're really in Paris.
Here you go, madame. Is that everything for you today?
That's all, thank you.
Okay then, that's €2.85 for you. Cash or card?
You know what, I got this one, Paula. Voilà, 3 euros et vous pouvez garder la monnaie.
Merci beaucoup, bonne journée. À vous, monsieur.
Ever the gentleman, this, dear listeners, is Guillaume Bernard. Remember last episode when we talked about social architecture and I said it was one of my own topics of research? Well, that's all thanks to Guillaume. Guillaume currently works as an environmental psychologist. He came from the research world where he did a PhD in urban planning and development. His thesis discussed how urban design shapes our behaviours and the quality of our lives. I met Guillaume at a conference last year and I was fascinated by his ideas. So I know he's going to have some gems of wisdom for us today.
Let's sit down while you drink your coffee. We don't do the takeaway thing here. Not our style.
I've got to respect the local customs. Thanks for joining me today, Guillaume. I wanted to meet up because I'm currently researching the topic of urban heat and how political structures can get organized around that issue. I know that you've been working closely with the city of Paris recently, so this felt like the perfect fit.
Yes, your timing couldn't be better. I've been doing consulting work with them to come up with new urban design solutions. They're currently redrafting their resilience strategy. I don't know if you've heard about this before.
Not the Paris one specifically, but I know a number of cities around the world are now making action plans to tackle urban heat. Some councils have even appointed chief heat resilience officers, right, to lead the way?
Yes, that's right. Most of these roles and action plans are seated at the city level, and they're government-led. Paris is quite interesting when it comes to heat management. It's very horizontal. They work to connect different industries together to look at heat as a global picture.
I'm really keen to hear more about the political wiring here in Paris. But before we get into that, what is Paris like when it's hot?
First thing to know about Paris, it's got one of the highest urban densities in Europe. This is related to the geography of the city itself. It's very restrictive. Paris is enclosed by a ring road, La Périph. So unlike somewhere like London, you can't just expand the city further and further. Or like, well, you can, but then it no longer is Paris. It's the region around Paris, Île-de-France, as we call it.
France's island?
Yep. 12 million people live in and around Paris. That's one in six people in France. And while not all of them live directly in the city, they do commute in daily. So that's a lot of people on the streets, in your buildings, on the roads. And when a heat wave comes, it gets really warm, really quickly. We also have fewer parks than capitals like London or Berlin. Our largest green areas are on the outside of the ring road. It's very inconvenient.
I can imagine that's a challenge for heat management. Would it be difficult to change the city layout, besides the ring road problem, I mean?
Yeah, hard question. You'll have to give me a bit of time to get to the bottom of it. But that's what today's all about. Are you done with your cafe?
Yep, ready to take the streets.
Super. You know, that is where it all happens in Paris. All right, Paula, let's start simple. Look around you and tell us what you see.
So we've just left the station and we're now walking down a large avenue. There's lots of traffic.
Yeah, that's Boulevard Magenta for you.
The pavement is lined with trees and we're looking at what I would say are pretty typical Paris apartment buildings. So the stuff from postcards, light grey stone, tall windows, ornate balconies, and of course, the metal roofs.
A classic Paris sight. A lot of the city looks like this. That's why tourists come to visit. It's rare for a place to look exactly as it does in pictures. But Paris kind of lives up to expectations. And we've got one man to thank for this. Baron Haussmann, or Haussmann.
Oh, wait. I know where you're going with this. You're going to talk about the Haussmann renovation, right?
Uh-huh. And it's funny you call it that. In French, we say Haussmann revolution.
Oh, my God. Of course you do.
I know. But I think if we want to understand why it's hard to adapt a city like Paris, we had to go back to the Haussmann Revolution. So if you don't mind, I've got a quick history lesson for you. But I promise, it's relevant to urban heat.
I'm excited to learn.
Great. So let's go back to the 1800s. You have to imagine that Paris, around that time, it's a city made of small, snake-like streets. It's hard to get around because you can't cross the city in a straight line. It's also very poorly lit and difficult to navigate at night. But this is all about to change because these are Napoleon times. We've got a brand new republic, and Napoleon commissions an ambitious project to redesign the city of Paris. And that's when he's introduced to Eugène Haussmann. Haussmann was a prefect, a state representative in regional France. Napoleon liked his style, so he brought Haussmann up to Paris, and they started meeting once a week to hash out the new Parisian design.
So, what was the main goal for Haussmann and Napoleon then? Was it to make the city easier to access?
That's part of it, yes. Haussmann's vision was to build large avenues that will help with airflows and transportation across the city. This is what we call the Grand Boulevard, or Grand Boulevards. He also wants to clean up Paris, so Haussmann commissions an extension of the sewage system. This interestingly turns Paris into a vertical city. Keep that in mind for later.
I will. So at what point do we start seeing the architecture that is everywhere here?
Just about the same time. In the late 1800s, more than 25,000 houses are taken down and replaced by buildings that can reach 6 stories tall. Now, you can have more people in each building. It frees up some space on the street, and it marks a major change in the urban landscape. Today, the cachet of that architecture makes the city very attractive around the world. But it's also important to remember that at the time, it's often the lower class that was displaced to make room.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I also remember reading that the layout of the typical apartment building says something about the class system of the time. Can you say more about that?
Absolutely. I can show you too.
We're now going through an archway that will take us into a typical sheltered courtyard away from the traffic.
Yes, just this way. Okay, so here we're in a pretty typical Haussmann courtyard. We've got the building block all around us, pebblestone paving. And if you look up, you can see that all the apartments have windows looking in. And then these sheltered spaces were handy for deliveries and such. They also offer some quiet and set you up for an interesting neighborhood life. From your window, you can easily peek into other people's homes.
Oh gosh, peeping Toms.
And over here, another interesting thing. With these buildings, you had two different entrances. Look, so there, front and center, you have the main residential entrance. And now, turn around.
Yep, I'm turning.
In the left corner there, that's the service staircase.
Ah.
This way, household staff could come and go without interfering with family life.
Different times, huh? I take it this is why we get the Chambre de Bonne at the top of the building.
Exactly. The master apartments are situated on accessible floors. Then, under the roof, you have the servants' quarters. And, well, these parts are not only smaller, they're built differently, too. On the lower floors, walls are thick and made of stone, which is great for insulation. It doesn't permeate water or temperature changes.
Mm-hmm.
At the top of the building, though, you're living under the roof, which is made of zinc. That's a metal, so it transfers heat. Now, the thing is, we still live with these design choices today. A study actually found that you're 4 times more likely to experience heat-related health issues when you live under a zinc roof. I've got a student who noted above 40 degrees in her apartment one summer.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, and that's another thing. Because these spaces are smaller and harder to access, they're cheaper to rent. That hasn't favored social mobility. You still have poor people living in the upper floors.
Oh, that's rough. That's really terrible. So, isn't the solution here to just adapt the building, get the roof refurbished, that kind of thing? We have similar issues in London, but it seems like homeowners have access to solutions.
I mean, yes, but it's not that simple. As you just heard, there's a history to these buildings. Sometimes they're listed, which means you can only renovate in specific ways. We also live in close proximity. You've got to contend with co-ownership. You need a consensus on these decisions. And you know what? It's hard to get everyone to choose heat resilience. The best way to achieve that, in my opinion, is regulation. And so far, the legal framework is geared towards health more than heat.
Yeah. There's a bit of a contradiction here, right? Heat has everything to do with health. So in a place like Paris, it does seem like resilience is largely about changing policies and updating regulations. That's how you start building a new kind of social architecture. And yes, that does imply handling the city's heritage differently too. So Guillaume, it kind of sounds like Paris needs a new Haussmann revolution.
I'm glad you said that. because I firmly believe that if it happened once, it can happen again, without the same social implications for lower-income households, that is.
I agree, and I think a great place to start is with government action. After all, who makes regulations, huh? What gets decided at the city level trickles down into our daily lives, and that's why I want us to meet a couple of people who have ties to the mayor's office today. They can give us the intel. You'll see.
I like the sound of that. When are we going to meet them?
Well, let's see. We've got just under 30 minutes. We better make our way down now.
Next stop, the Canal Saint-Martin. This waterway runs through central and northeast Paris. Here, while it's not officially a pedestrian zone, it's clear that cars have lost the battle. Parisians love to come cycling and walking along the water, and there's not much room for traffic. The canal is framed by row after row of cafes, shops, and restaurants. It's a quintessential spot for local residents. And it's where we're meeting today's guests, Eliane and Clément. These two Parisians work with the mayor's office and are going to tell us more about the city's political landscape and its commitment to heat resilience. It's lovely around here. Reminds me of East London in some ways, believe it or not.
That's the canal for you. Although, are you able to swim in the Thames water?
Oh, for my own good, I'd rather not.
Thought so. Right now, it is possible to dive in here. It was one of the goals with the Olympics this year, to clean up the Seine. This summer, people were dipping in. It was lovely to see. I mean, talk about managing heat waves. That would be a great resource to freshen up on hot days.
Mm-hmm.
But truth be told, we're not exactly sure how long we'll be able to keep the canal accessible. The issue is not just depolluting the streams, it's also predicting what rains and runoff waters will bring in and when, and with global warming, you know.
Yeah, it's really hard to control. From an environmental perspective, we're working with unsteady predictions from one year to the next. I think that's why we need to rely on different kinds of solutions, not just the blue or green infrastructures.
Where are we going, by the way?
Oh, to Café Prune. It should be somewhere down here.
Ah, yes, it's that. You see that Burgundy Brasserie over there?
Ah, there they are.
Paola. Paola? Paola? Hi, nice to finally meet you in person.
Yes, hi. It's nice to see you.
Oh, and you must be Guillaume.
Enchanté.
Enchanté. I'm Eliane Vermé. I work at the mayor's office.
On s'est installé en terrasse. Ça vous dérange pas?
Bah non, 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 pas du tout. Et du coup, vous êtes?
Voilà, Guillaume, this is Clément Damas.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Clément is a vendor who we met through some of the initiatives we run. You guys should sit down, by the way. I'll get the waiter.
Oh, thanks. So, what kind of business do you run, Clément?
I have a small chain of restaurants called Les Marmitons. We've got different locations around Paris. We do both city and county in Thai food, but also catering.
That sounds amazing, and to be honest, I'm not sure yet how that's linked to urban heat, but I'm excited to find out.
What did you guys want? Coffee, something like that?
I'm okay, actually. I just had one.
Maybe just a soft drink?
Sure, yeah, yeah. S'il vous plaît, deux grenadines. Vous les ajouterez à ma note? Merci beaucoup.
So Guillaume, Eliane here is part of the civil services of the mayor's office. She's currently with the Ecological Transition and Climate Adaptation Department. On the day-to-day, her role is to develop the city's climate plan. She was put in charge of heat resilience. So Eliane, what was that project, the climate plan?
Oh, yeah. So the climate plan is a strategy to adjust and respond to global warming. It's in the name, you know. It includes every area of industry and social work. So the energy sector, food, culture, education, you name it. The goal is to touch every cog in the system and collaborate with different people, different actors to reach our objectives.
I see.
We have different teams to achieve these goals. Mine is focused on urban heat and heat resilience. Oh, and just as an aside, you know, the Paris Climate Plan, it was voted best climate plan globally about a year and a half ago. To me, this is truly a testament to how hard our executives push us. It takes a lot of people to make changes.
So, do you mind explaining how the political system works in Paris? You just mentioned you were part of a department, but you've got a specialized team, and since you're on the civil side, I'm assuming that you weren't elected.
I know, it's kind of confusing, isn't it? So the city government is organized around an executive team. They've got a 6-year mandate. And then there are several deputies who assist the elected mayor with their responsibilities. Each deputy is attached to one department. And so that department is going to be in charge of different missions. Sustainability, climate transition, energy, water, you know, that kind of thing. And then, this is where it gets complicated, within that we've got specialized teams that work on targeted questions. Merci beaucoup. Anyways, so like I said, you've got the elected and the civil technical side. And we're working hand in hand. You know, we've got the same goals. They're set out at the beginning of each term, and we're here to implement them.
It seems like the commitment to issues like heat resilience would depend on each mandate then. So how committed is the city of Paris this term?
Yeah, I'd say our mayor, Anne Hidalgo, she has strong social and environmental ambitions. One of her goals is to make Paris entirely pedestrian. I mean, this is an effort to reduce fine particles in the air, make the city more breathable. Mm-hmm. So I think that's incredibly relevant to urban heat.
Yeah.
The thing is, she's meeting some resistance to implement it, but at the end of the day, she is building it up. Every Sunday now, we've got large traffic areas everywhere in the city shutting down, becoming entirely walkable. Even large avenues like the Champs-Élysées, for example, they don't get any weekend traffic. And in the long term, that's bound to become permanent.
Really?
It's a large adaptation measure for sure.
I guess it shouldn't come as a surprise. I mean, the city is known for being at the forefront of this work. What with the Paris Agreement?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, you know, people often talk about the COP21 because it's a turn in our political history. I mean, for everybody. But that was what, 2015, 2016, something like that. What most people don't know is that in 2003, France went through a truly devastating heat wave. I mean, it was the first of its kind, really. And for us in France, it left a huge legacy. People remember what they were doing that year.
Okay, I didn't know that.
At the time, heat resilience plans were not mandatory for cities, but suddenly, well, global warming felt real. It was a wake-up call for decision makers. So the city of Paris took on a new approach. They worked on the climate plan, started addressing key issues like energy consumption, adaptation, and so on. We matured our strategies over time. And in 2012, when we adopted our second climate plan, it was much more comprehensive.
That's pretty early.
Actually, that year, the city carried out extensive research in urban development. I dug into it during my PhD. They did a study assessing the vulnerability of the Parisian territory to climate change and resource scarcity. And then they conducted that research again in 2020 using the same method. They looked at climate projections and their possible impacts on various systems in the city. Transportation, public health, energy, telecommunications, etc., etc.
I see. So the Parisian authorities have basically been running diagnostics for a long time.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we use these findings as the foundation of our policies, our action, whatever it is we do. Now, the tough news is that the risks we had identified in 2012 are advancing much faster than we had expected. What we thought was coming in 2050 should be here in 2030. So we have to enter an era where the focus is on adaptation. That means we need to work with all sides of civil society, citizens, associations, you know, the business sector. It's a all hands on deck situation.
Time is of the essence. Listening to Eliane here, it's clear that Paris has a long history of commitment to climate and heat resilience. But I'm curious to know how that turns into action. And I think her last point is important. Raising awareness, connecting with our institutions is a necessary step, but it can be difficult to get everyone aligned. So how do you bridge the gap between the public and the private sector then?
Well, one of the things we've created is a program called Paris Action Climat Biodiversité. That's Paris Action Climate and Biodiversity. So that's that program encourages businesses based in Paris to sign a charter that commits to resilience. That might mean that the company reduces their energy consumption, emissions, resource use, etc. And you know, the thing is, adaptation is actually a growing area of interest for businesses because a business owner is just as concerned by environmental risks as everybody else. That's actually how we came in contact with Clément over here.
Ta-da!
That's the connection. Okay, so Clément, what brought you to consider this program?
A couple of different things. On the one hand, it was a natural extension of our credo.
I think you could say mantra.
Your mission statement?
Yes, that's it. So I built my business with a group of very socially engaged people, and we wanted to promote sustainable food. I work with local produce. We try to do zero, close to zero waste policies. And you know, it's great. But something that I kept at the back of my mind was, we're not just a restaurant, we're a business in our region. And I wanted to have a model that could adapt to changes in the city. If tomorrow Paris is a car-free city, that will change how we get deliveries, right? I don't want us to be caught off guard. I want us to be ahead of the game. So we're making changes now. For example, every week we supply elementary schools with their lunch meals. Well, now we just do that with delivery bikes.
Oh, that's great. Are you able to load large quantities on a bike? How did you make that happen?
There's a chain of supermarkets here that started a delivery service with these same bikes. They signed the charter too, so we were able to learn from each other. And, you know, the bikes, they're electric. That makes it easy to go up and down the hills on Pebble Street and so on. They've got a large box at the back. But you're right. You can't fit the same quantity in. So we had to reassess how much time and staff we typically need for this service. But that's what adaptation is, you know? And to have support from the mayor's office, that really helped a lot.
In many ways, it seems like initiatives connect companies to a new network of partnerships. I feel like that's also part of social architecture. It's about building new structures that will support resilience long term. Not just, hey, we're adapting to temperatures now. We need to react to the situation. More like, hey, let's be proactive. Let's get together and bridge the gaps in our knowledge so that whatever comes our way, we're prepared. And you need new peers to do that. Would you agree, Eliane?
Yeah, totally. I mean, in this case, more is more. The more entrepreneurs and business owners sign up, the more they can collaborate with each other. And that's how we get innovation.
Speaking of innovation, have you seen new heat technologies through this incentive, or is that not your main focus?
Let me see. One company that works with us is called Fraîcheur de Paris, Paris Freshness. They're in the tech and energy space, and they provide an alternative to AC. Their idea was to supply cooling water to buildings like a reverse heating system. And basically, they've built these cooling tanks that are powered on renewable energy. So that works with underground water distribution drawn from the Seine. And they supply their cooling services for about 700 institutions like hotels, shopping centers, office spaces, museums, that kind of thing. They're really growing and spreading that heat resilience expertise, you know?
What a game changer. That's really exciting.
Actually, Paula, do you remember earlier when I said about the Haussmann revolution turning Paris into a vertical city? So this is also what I meant. Paris has a huge underground network that we use for transportation, water waste, and so on. But it also holds potential for heat resilience, too. So imagine if, instead of walking around a concrete city that is baking under the sun, imagine if you could use well-ventilated underground corridors. If we extended what already exists, we could carve out spaces that are a refuge from the heat. And those are not as vulnerable to environmental change.
Oh, you know what, Guillaume? Paris at 50 degrees looked into that.
Paris at 50 degrees?
They did a crisis management scenario and they planned out how to evacuate vulnerable groups during a heatwave shutdown. They identified that disused tunnels in the close suburbs of Paris were prime cooling spots.
I've heard of this. That's the urban heat awareness campaign I saw floating around Twitter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's much more than a campaign, actually. It was a project commissioned by the mayor's office to prepare all the services on the public and the private side for, you know, events of extreme heat. Then we also turned it into a campaign so that we could touch a broader public. But it took us about a year to put everything together.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. So what kind of research did you carry out?
I think I might not be the best person to answer you here, but I know just the guy. So give me a second. Let me see. Allô, Alexandre? Ça va? Je te dérange pas? Je suis en train de boire un café avec mon amie Paola et...
The voice on the other end of the line is Alexandre Florentin. He's a City of Paris deputy who is elected on the Green Party list. His background is in environmental engineering, and he has founded a consultancy cabinet called Carbon 4. Between July 2022 and April 23, he presided over the Paris at 50 degrees initiative. And because Eliane is the kind of person who makes things happen...
Bah attends, je leur demande. Do you guys have anything on after this, or...?
Well, she's getting us places. Alexandra's office is a quick 10 minutes away, just off the Place de la République. And in between a few meetings, we managed to catch a moment with him to discuss how Paris at 50 degrees came to be. Okay, so we've got the recorder on. We're here in a very quiet office, how lucky. I know we've not got much time together, so I'll cut to the chase. Alexandre, when did you start working on Paris 50 degrees?
Déjà en 2017, alors que je suis pas élu.
Sure. So back in 2017, before I was elected, I had read a scientific study from Météo France, our national meteorological centre. It reported that in the second half of the 21st century, we would experience temperatures between 50 and 55 degrees in mainland France. At that time, I was already well versed on heat and climate change, but even so, I thought, this can't be right. It really stayed with me. Then, when I got elected, there was an open research opportunity that needed leadership, so I volunteered to preside over it. Our goal was to discuss every possible question when it comes to urban heat. We conducted about 40 interviews in my own district, the 13th arrondissement in southeast Paris. I spoke to a school director, a clinic manager, and various city services, like the morgue, for example. We raised questions like, when we get excess deaths during a heatwave, what does that mean for funeral services? The point was to ask, how did you handle previous heatwaves? And how are you preparing for future ones? They're simple questions that everyone can try to answer, and any institution can pick up that exercise and replicate it.
So far, it seems like Paris at 50 degrees was really research-based, but I know you were able to market it across different platforms. I mean, I came across it on Twitter originally. Did you do that?
Once we had done this research, we didn't want it to be just another report that no one reads. So we turned it into a fictional story. We published it on Twitter, and actually, it coincided with record-breaking heatwaves in 2022. So it earned some really positive feedback. The Paris Executive City Government adopted our recommendations, and they went on to organise some crisis management drills to educate the population. We figured out how to direct populations seeking refuge to fresh spaces, places with robust AC systems, like elderly care homes. These events were great to create media coverage, but another side of the project that went under the radar was a tabletop role-playing game we did with city services. It wasn't open to the press, but each industry and service was represented, private and public sector alike. I found this fascinating and so helpful.
Between their research and these situational exercises, the City of Paris put together 80 measures to respond to urban heat and heat-related emergencies. Only one of these measures uses technology, which means they are all applicable now. What's more, this body of work was approved by all political parties across the spectrum.
Politicians aren't here to invent things. They're here to listen and then translate insights into political action. Ultimately, when you read the recommendations, you realise that over the next 10 to 20 years, the viability of the city is at stake. We'll have to make major decisions, which could differ slightly from one political voice to another. However, if we focus on what is essential for living together, we can get to the heart of the heat resilience question. Politics are a performative discourse. When collectively we all say that we're doing something, it seeds what happens next.
I think the idea that political discourse is performative is really interesting. If you think about environmental psychology, the way our physical environment defines our lifestyle, the things we do, and even our thinking, that's not limited to our immediate location. Social space plays a role too. The laws we draft, the social norms we move, the layers of our day-to-day, from our local supermarket changing their delivery options to our children's school doing heat prevention, that's all social architecture too. Urban heat is an opportunity to come together for change. We need to pave the road now to secure the next 5, 10, 20 years. And that road entails a new kind of architecture, not just the Haussmannian sort, but a social one too. Social architecture is what happens when we reshape our habits and our beliefs on every level. It's a tipping point after a long series of actions. The urgency and need for adaptation should be a catalyst. We need to have a collective conversation because the moment we're building together, neighbor to neighbor, business to business, public and private hand in hand, we become a community that can mobilize a political will. Seeing what's currently unfolding here in Paris, I'm starting to see how we can put these pieces together.
All right, so if you're going to Orly Airport, you need to take the 14. It's a direct line, automatic, so you won't have any issues with the strike. Really easy.
Yeah, easy, if you find the platform first. It's like a maze in here.
You're not wrong. Châtelet is one of the biggest stations in the city. And the metro, it's old and far from perfect. But the 14 is one of our most recent lines. You'll be just fine.
Ah, oh, that's good to hear.
Ah, Paula, we're on the right here.
Three minutes until the next train. So Guillaume, we've got little time left together. What's your final word for today? How would you sum up what's needed for political action?
Well, I think there are essentially three steps. Number one, start with commitment. Local governments need to build a program, goals, and fitting strategies for implementation. Without a clear line of vision, we won't get to the end of the road. Then, step two, we've got to solidify our partnerships. So that means getting key actors to engage with the research and adopt urban heat recommendations. Beyond the public sector, the people we need on our side are entrepreneurs, executives from large groups, basically great business minds that can change the landscape on the private side. And lastly, my third point. Can't reach these people without raising awareness. So we want a discourse that can bring different perspectives together and convey the urgency of the heat question. We need all our services to have emergency plans in place so they can react to crises effectively. Ultimately, we need the public to seize this heat resilience knowledge and work towards it on their own terms.
I know what you mean. I think something else I'd like to take away from today is the challenge that existing regulations can pose for resilience. In older cities like London or Paris, there's a need to balance out historical conservation and adaptation. We need to accept that things won't stay the same and reconcile the layout of a densely built city with the possibility of innovation. But as you said, the Tasmanian revolution shows us that it's possible.
Yeah, and if we follow up on our mayor's vision, we do have a chance to get there. I like to think that we're at least somewhere along the way, you know?
I think you are too. All right, I think this is me. That was short. Sorry I have to jump, but thank you so much, Guillaume.
Non, mais merci à toi. Thank you so much for coming and best of luck with your travels. Now go. You got to get your train. Bon voyage.
On my way to the airport, I finally get some time to wrap my mind around today's trip. And there's one thing that keeps coming back. Today, we really got to dissect how the Paris city government works from the inside. We saw its reach and its limitations, and it shed light on a different reality. So often when we talk about social change, we think top down. I mean, remember, that is what Guillaume was saying at the beginning of the episode. You need regulations to make things happen. And of course, that's true. But it's not the full picture either. If you want to build resilience as a lifestyle, you need to rope in economic, social, and political powers. That means connecting with the private sector, building a community, making resilience accessible and appealing to everyone. And that doesn't happen through adaptation alone. Nope, it requires innovation, in the truest sense of the word. So maybe it's time to look a little further afield, in places that were built on innovation. Maybe it's time to cross the Atlantic. I'll see you on the other side. The Philanthropist Conversation is a podcast from Pegasus made in collaboration with a team at Lower Street. Research and content direction by Ivan C. Writing and production from Lise Lavati with the help of Sam Datapollin and Ryan Sutton. Sound design by Alex Bennett. Voice acting Yvette Murda Silva, Kieran Cresswell, Stephen Bernard, Ryan Sutton, and Lise Lavati. The Philanthropist Conversation is a fictional piece based on real interviews with researchers, policymakers, and experts in the field of heat resilience. To continue learning about urban heat, head to the show notes to find the resources used in the making of this episode. We want to thank Lenio Meravigli and Julie Russell for their valued contribution, and Alexandra Florentine for bringing his voice to this episode for a privileged interview.